Stupid, eh? Are you a stupid fool? Well, why can't you drive then? You can't even drive! Bit grey today, isn't it?
Well, hello, ladies and gentlemen. Hello. Welcome back to the Deepest Lore. After we were away last week, the Beyond Meat show has been postponed until next week, when Farrah will be back with the Pastor Ozzy. Furious, but today, well, how can I say? First of all, before I do all that, let me get some shillings out of the way. My Substack, which has become, ladies and gentlemen, the number one Substack in the world in the category of politics, terrorism, and political economy. That is the category, and I don't know why, but that's just how they categorize it. Politics, terrorism, and political economy. The number one Substack in the world, ladies and gentlemen. So you should subscribe to that. It's all behind the paywall, but you may get some interesting thoughts if you subscribe to that. Also, I finally completely finished the script part of Foundations of Politics last night. And we're zeroing in on that actually coming out. So I just have the recording process to go, really. So there we go. People are saying it proves I'm a fed. Yes. Anyway, my ambition on Substack is to take over Curtis Yarvin, wherever he is in the rankings. You know, clearly he didn't tag his. I don't think he tagged his Substack with that category. Otherwise, he would surely be above me. But I want to beat Yarvin. That's my new lifetime goal. Anyway, yeah. People in the chat are saying, "Where is he? Where is?"
Sure. I would say. Sure. Yeah. Sure. 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 And so.
Okay. Now. If you're new to this channel, if you've never seen this show before, usually we talk about culture and arts on The Deepest Lore, but every once in a while we take some time out to do a little bit of in-depth analysis on the rhetorical stylings, on the Hello, ladies and gentlemen, can you still hear me? This is live. People watching. I accidentally knocked my mic. I knocked my mic, all right? So there we go. Yes. Yeah, I can see Charlemagne, Tragic Vision. So there we go. I just knocked my mic, that's all. Anyway. Every once in a while, so this show is usually about art, culture, things like that. But every once in a while, we like to take a little bit of time out to study the rhetorical stylings, the persuasion techniques, the art of dark framing employed by this man here, the Dark Lord himself, Tony Blair. Also, if you are new to this channel, it's not fucking pre-recorded. Stop this lies, okay? I'm at home. I'm not at the lodge. I'm at home, but I am doing this right now. The other thing to mention before we get into this, like why would we take note of what the former prime minister, you know, last in charge of this country in 2007, 2008, why would we take note of what he says? Why is it important what Tony Blair says in a speech like this for his own institute? And the reason for that is that for anybody paying attention, even though the de jure leader of the United Kingdom is Boris Johnson, you know, he holds the office of prime minister. He is nominally in charge of the government. Everybody knows that the real leader of the United Kingdom, the de facto leader, the commissar of the globalists, the agent of William Fence, the agent of the World Economic Forum, the point man for our global rulers, is Tony Blair. He is here to ensure that the UK does not go too far afield. And I have a feeling that after after the Tories have essentially reneged on continuing whatever the plan was, that the Dark Lord is displeased. So when the Dark Lord gives a speech on the future of Britain, it's an insight into what the globalists are thinking, and how they, if the globalists had completely had their own way, Blair would just be directly running the show. And, you know, but of course, the reason that the Tories and the Boris Johnson can't do that is that he does have pressure from his base. He does have pressure from the public. He feels the direct consequences. And of course, you know, more than anything else, Boris is a politician. He has to respond to, you know, polling. They freaked out about that seat that they lost. So I think there is a bit of like grubby everyday politics involved with this. That has caused the UK, as far as I can see, to diverge from what the rest of Europe is doing and from the plan. Globalists also got a massive setback in America after the Supreme Court struck down the vaccine mandates, and companies like Starbucks, for example, now have basically suspended the vax mandates for their employees. As far as I know, NHS staff are going to start to be fired in April in this country, and it's still, you know, there are still some companies in America like enforcing the, you know, saying basically get the vaccine or you're fired. But basically, because it's been struck down by the Supreme Court, you know, a lot of people in the past week or so have been saying, well, it's over, like the narrative is done, whatever the elites wanted to do, they've got out of this already. But then other people are pointing out, well, hold on a second, it's still going full steam ahead in the EU. They're announcing their vaccine passports and so on and so forth. So what's going on? I think it's worth listening to Blair to get an insight here into, you know, maybe there are competing factions at play within the elites. Certainly, it is obvious now, I think, to everybody that Boris Johnson is not quite, he's not like, he may be a coward. He may be spineless. He may be unable to stand up to his wife. He may be a disappointment to everybody. But it seems like Boris is not quite their guy, that they would prefer to have somebody who is more compliant in that role, which suggests to me that they want to get rid of Boris Johnson. But anyway, let us see what the Dark Lord has to say. He was also interviewed after this speech by CNN, by Christine Amanpour. So we're going to watch that as well. I'm going to analyze in real time his speech and then the CNN interview. Okay, get ready for this, folks. Hold on. I haven't opened. Boris is not on our side. Yes, absolutely. He's not our guy. He's not on our side, but he's a politician who, much like Trump, has a survival instinct. Basically, he wants to save his own skin. And if that means not complying with globalists' wishes, so be it, you know. And I think that, I think basically he's gone for broke now. He's like, listen, we can't take this. We're getting hammered in the polls. I've got a we're losing seats that we've held for 200 years. I've got a minus 50% approval rating. Fucking hell, come on. You know, they know that people didn't elect them to do what they've been doing. Okay, so I think Boris is like finally just out of political survival, you know, he's just not playing ball with these guys anymore. So I get the impression, I mean, I haven't watched this speech yet. I've been interested to you as what he's got to say, but I get the impression that the Dark Lord, newly Sir Tony Blair, is displeased. Okay, so let us see what he's got to say.
Pleasure to...
Hold on. Can people hear this?
Please join me in welcoming Tony Blair to the stage. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Aaron. Welcome, everyone. It's a great pleasure to see people here. As a result of, obviously, still the COVID restrictions, it's a smaller group of people than we otherwise would have assembled, but thank you so much for coming. I'm really honored that you have, and Ara is one of the people I respect most in public life. He's a thinker who's also a practitioner, and a practitioner who's also a leader. It's a pretty rare combination, so I'm absolutely thrilled to have your introduction, and thank you, Ara, for the kind welcome, and thank you also to the Institute of Global Health Innovation for hosting today's event. I can't think of any better place to speak with you about the future of Britain.
By the way, this is a Blair trope. He always does this. He always sucks up to whoever just introduced him, wherever he is. It's you know, if you ever watch pro wrestling, Mick Foley does this, you know. It's great to be here in Phoenix, Arizona, and the crowd goes, well, I mean, this is just, you know, the polite Tony Blair version of that. So,
and an institution like Imperial College, which is a tremendous global leader in science, engineering, medicine, and business. The achievements of Imperial researchers are enormous. And are not just reserved for the 14 Nobel Prize winners, from the discovery of penicillin to the development of holography to the invention of fiber optics and to groundbreaking engineering projects like the Maglev Railway. And of course, Imperial has played an important role in the response to the COVID pandemic, most notably the REACT study led by ARA and a talented team here at Imperial.
Extended cheap pop. He's really bigging up the venue here.
The REACT program has become one of the world's biggest studies of community COVID. The testing of it particularly, and has been instrumental in tracking the progress of the epidemic here in this country. But I know also that this study has been of invaluable and great help as a source of data for policymakers all over the world, and we should be immensely grateful to them.
Just a reminder, it was fucking Imperial who had the Professor Neil Ferguson. You know, so all of this praise that he's just given, you know, just glances over the awful predictions made by Ferguson, you know, Professor Lockdown. He got it all wrong, famously. And yet, here he is being praised to the hilt by, you know, the Knight of the Order of the Realm, or whatever the fuck he's called now.
So, to turn to the speech, which is the future of Britain in an era of what I've called the three revolutions. And
people are also pointing out in the chat that Imperial are beneficiaries of the same patron that Tony Blair has, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. So,
I start by saying there's a gaping hole in the governing of Britain where new ideas should be. We're living through three revolutionary changes simultaneously and are ill-prepared for any of them. Each of them would require major changes in the way we work as a nation. All of them together pose a challenge which is unprecedented in recent history. The changes are Brexit, the technology revolution, and a climate ambition which foresees a unique transition to being carbon neutral in the power sector.
People who think this climate change thing is going to go away, it's a mess. I mean, we're going to be doing the Beyond Meat next week. This is massively coming, and they're not just telegraphing it, they are screaming it. You read that CEO letter from Larry Fink from last week, Blair again mentioning it here. You look at the World Economic Forum stuff. This is where they're really going to go for this Agenda 2030 climate change thing now. They're really going to go for it.
It's over a decade and the whole country in 25 years. COVID-19 has in some senses masked the scale of the challenge because it has been its own extraordinary crisis. But as it recedes...
yeah, it's own crisis, but we've just used it for all of those purposes, you know. Still not letting Brexit go, by the way. Notice he's still not letting Brexit go. Probably the only man in Britain not to let Brexit go still.
Or at least becomes managed, the following will become starkly clear. By end 2022, we were the highest tax burden and the largest spending by the state since the post-war period. Our debt will be higher than at any time in the last half century, and our sustainable growth rates in the next years will be around 1.7%, nowhere near those of the first part of this century, and woefully inadequate to pay for the services we expect.
And yet, I saw figures from the Welsh government that 60% of the state spending in Wales goes to fucking climate change. So, yeah, all of that. But, like, look at where our priorities are as well. Still in the face of all of that that you just listed, they are, you know, allocating huge amounts of budget to this Agenda 2030 deal. So...
for the average household, taxes will rise by around...
Oh, yeah. And when he said the first part of the century, he was saying, like, i.e., when I was in charge, the economy was rocking and rolling. So...
around £370 per year. Energy prices by £600. They will be asked to swap gas boilers for heat pumps and their conventional fuel cars for electric vehicles. The costs of
that's fucking mad. I mean, the thing is, right, before we carry on, Blair knows, because he's got such an instinct for the public. He knows that this is going to be really dangerous for the elites. Okay. The elites know that they are very, very unpopular at the moment. There was that footage that came out of the World Economic Forum the other day where she literally said, you know, as the elites have got friendlier and allow us to do, like, what did she say? Let me pull up that quotation because it was just incredible. It was so good. I put it in Foundation of the Politics. Pull up exactly what she said. Let's have a look. Hold on. Yeah, I'm just going to pull up this quote from this woman from the World Economic Forum, because this is a new theme with the elites this year. It's like they've recognized that everybody hates them, basically. Like the pandemic maybe has made them realize how hated they are. She said, at Davos a few years ago, the Edelman survey showed us that the good is that the elite across the world trust each other more and more, so we can come together and design and do beautiful things together. The bad news is that in every single country, they were polling, the majority of people trusted the elite less. They know that. Blair will have looked at what's happening at in France. They would have looked at the reaction to the carbon taxes. And he knows that this transition is going to be very painful. Of course, that's not going to deter the likes of him and the globalists. But I think it represents like a significant challenge to them. Like, how the hell do they put in this transition they want to put in without like widespread violence breaking out? Because like seriously, how are you going to force the public to swap like essentially better technologies for worse technologies and more expensive technologies? I mean, I've had one of these gas meters put, like the smart meters put in. I know everybody went nuts at me for doing that. But one of the things the smart meter does is that it reminds you of how much you're spending every day on energy. It's like this little, it's like a little screen. And Jesus Christ, just this past week, we spent like 26 quid on gas and electricity, just in like in real time. You can see it going up. I'm sure that's not normal. I'm sure it's way more expensive than it usually was. So yeah, there is huge inflation in energy at the moment. And, you know, if that's hurting me, I don't know what it's doing to people who are like on the breadline or, you know, on minimum wage or whatever. So anyway, let's carry on.
Foodstuffs are going up and general inflation will cause rises in interest rates. Business will see the biggest shift and uplift in corporation tax since the 1970s, whilst investment is 12% below pre-Brexit amounts. Our productivity levels, the real test of an economy's strength, and the key to real wage rises are stagnating. Now, we retain significant strengths. Our universities, our leading edge technology, particularly in areas like the life sciences, which post-COVID is a huge asset, and now in climate technologies like renewables. We've got the City of London as a global financial center still. Creative industries, our language, our culture, historic and present connectivity to so much of the world. There is no cause, therefore, for pessimism, but there is an urgent need for realism in the face of these revolutions. Without a radical shift in policy, we face a steady, inexorable compound decline similar to the 1960s and 1970s. It could be several years before we realize this, but with our present course, we're relegating ourselves to a league which is poorer, less prosperous, and less powerful.
All of that is true. Everything you just said is true.
I hesitate when I hear the government slogan, leveling up. Other than a desire to give opportunity to those without it, which obviously is hard to disagree with, the slogan risks misdirecting the framing of the country's problem. We face a national challenge, all of the country, not simply the areas left behind. So to the revolutions, Brexit is a word most of us want to forget. Understandably, it was a deeply divisive period.
Look at it. He can't fucking take the loss. Take the L, Tony. Look at that. Look at him. He's fucking fuming still. Take the L, Tony.
It was a divided time. And indeed, it's done. The debate about its wisdom is over. But it was a decision of consequence. And the consequence we cannot ignore, however much we may want to. According to the government's forecast on current policy, we will suffer a long-term 4% drop.
Is it just me, or does Tony feel a little bit more shaken? Like he's not quite himself. He feels rattled in this. Like he's looking at the teleprompter. He's not his usual slick self. There's something up with Tone. Press 1 in the chat if you think there's something up with Tony. I think there's something up with him. He doesn't feel Like, people are just saying he's old. It's something I feel like, because I've seen him recently and he's been a lot more energetic than this. So, I don't know, he feels rattled to me.
Drop in GDP. The preparations as a result of exiting the single market have cost the government directly over £4 billion and probably much, much more to the private sector. Brexit uncertainty is one of the top three concerns of 40% of British business. And leave aside Northern Ireland, we don't yet have deals on the city, financial services, or any part of the services sector.
I mean, I will say the pandemic basically obliterated Brexit from the news, from people's minds, from column inches. It's basically almost been disappeared in our consciousness. And yet all of these talking points about trade deals and so on, which would have been the news if the pandemic hadn't happened. I mean, if these things haven't been done, again, what has Boris's government actually been doing? Like, I mean, yes, the pandemic, but they should have had people working on that 24/7 as well behind the scenes. Like, why isn't it done? Why is it not done?
There are tariff borders on industrial goods. And we face a situation where we're shut out of Europe when Europe is taking decisions across a range of issues which deeply affect us.
I mean, is this Morgoth's vaccine passports, the green pass or whatever? Like, all of Europe is getting his ID passes and he is fucking fuming. I'm telling you, I've been watching Blair a long time. He is fuming. He is unhappy. The synergy between what Europe is doing and the UK is doing is diverging. And this is not good from his agenda's point of view.
We can alter our political and legal relationship with Europe, but we cannot change our interests or our geography. The government doesn't have a post-Brexit regulatory strategy, and it is letting passive divergence from the EU exacerbate costs for businesses for no purpose, deepening an already substantial economic hit from Brexit itself.
Listen to that phrasing. Passive divergence from the EU. Very interesting phrase.
We need to decide what our new trade relations with Europe should be, where we can easily align with European regulation and where, practically, we want to depart from it and have a whole area where we're intending to deepen our European relationship for the future in areas like defence, energy, and the environment.
The environment. There's a lot in that word, I tell you.
Above all, we need to make our economy highly competitive, attract world-class talent, and make our independence from the EU a platform for economic growth. But it needs a plan into which hard work and thought has gone, policy detail, strategic analysis, and at present there isn't one.
Why aren't we fucking managing it? Tony's saying, where are the managers? But I mean, there is also a truth to this. If it's true that the Tories have just been like sitting on their asses, you know, Boris with his thumb up his ass talking about masks and so on, what have they fucking been doing for the past 2 years? He's right. He'd like as much as we hate him, he is also right. Like, if there isn't a plan, why not? Why aren't they thinking about what's happening? So,
The technology revolution is the most important and most impactful of the three revolutions. But talk to many policymakers about tech, and to be fair, this is not a purely British phenomenon, and they're much more comfortable talking about regulating Facebook than setting out the opportunities, for example, of education technology to change the way we teach and learn, or how the National Health Service should be completely rethought in how it's structured and paid for. Yet over the coming decade, this revolution will disrupt virtually every part of our lives, including our working lives.
More Earth is in a cold sweat somewhere if he's watching this. Fucking hell.
Advances in artificial intelligence will be dramatic. Whole sectors of the economy, both services and manufacturing, will feel the impact. As many as 9 million jobs could be automated, though of course new jobs will also be created. It's a revolution in the labor market. Here the government does have a plan of sorts, but measure the government's plan against the scale of the change, and it is immediately apparent how short it is from what is necessary.
See, this is the thing. I mean, this is like the pure managerial mindset. He cannot let anything to chance. It must be planned. It must be, you know, thought out. There must be a 5-year, a 10-year, 15-year, 20-year plan. But if you think about the way other governments function, the planning time horizon of Russia and China, for example, this is what he's got him. Like, he's thinking like any country that is serious about its position in the world has to think on these very long time horizons. Whereas Boris, as we talked about at the start, is just thinking about his own electoral chances. You know, his time horizon is extremely short. He's just looking to the next election. He's just looking to the latest poll and so on. So, in a way, I can see, you know, from a pure like geopolitical and power stance, I can understand where Tony, like what he's saying here, even if we disagree with the sort of plan that he would come up with, there should be some sort of strategy when it comes to this, especially those 9 million jobs that are going to be lost that he was talking about, because that's coming down the pike. Tucker Carlson talks about this as well. So what are they going to fucking do about it? I'm not getting seduced. I'm just saying that. I mean, this is the genius of Blair in a way. He says things that are true, okay? He does. And then he gets you to agree with him. But then when he suggests the solution, it's not a solution that you would agree with in a million years, or any of us would agree with in a million years. But he's still diagnosing a correct problem here. I mean, when was the last time you heard any of the government talk like this? They just don't. They just don't even address these things.
Net zero by 2050. It's the right commitment, with interim stretching targets in power, transport, and construction for 2035. But just think of what these correct but vastly ambitious climate commitments mean. In little over 10 years, we will have to double electricity supply, replace the present heating systems in 10 million homes, turn 20 million fossil fuel cars into scrap and replace them with electric vehicles.
How are they fucking going to do this? I still can't see how they achieve what he's talking about without experiencing a revolution or circulation of elites, or, you know, at the very least, extremely violent protests. I just don't see how they're going to do that. Like that is just those few things he mentioned there is an enormous undertaking. I very much struggle. I mean, maybe I don't have the vision of Tony. How are they going to do it?
And create renewables at 4 times the present rate.
How are they going to do that? 4 times the present rate of renewables, and we know that renewables barely fucking work already. This is madness. And he's worried about the economy.
And all whilst losing the revenue which comes from fuel duty, which will amount to an annual shortfall of some £20 billion by 2035.
Holy shit. What are they doing? Like, I mean, in a weird way, this is also an admission of chronic mismanagement and the stupidity of this vision that he has got. I mean, this is the thing that, you know, he never will accept any responsibility himself for any of these problems. But, you know, we don't need to do this because India and China won't do it. Russia's not going to do it. And so when we are literally shooting ourselves in the foot, literally just destroying our economy, destroying our infrastructure, destroying our technology advantage, you know, you're just literally handing, you know, leverage to our competitor nations that you're so concerned about. So why would you ever do this? This is just madness. But anyway.
There is absolutely no way this can be done without, amongst other things, major changes in planning laws, investment in new nuclear capacity, using gas as a transitional fuel, reform of electricity markets, and a credible strategy for switching our homes to low carbon heating.
By the way, that little statement he made there, using gas as a transitional fuel, if you go to last week's cigar stream where me, Semiagogue, Prudentialist, and Otto looked at the gas pipe situation at some depth in and around Syria, I'll give you a bit more insight into the increasing strategic importance of gas. Yeah, let's carry on.
But show me the plan to do this. The point is, these triple revolutions necessitate a vast reordering of government's priorities, its policies, its personnel, how it's structured. It requires a level of coherence so that, for example, what we do on taxation does not cut across what we do to stay competitive. What we want to do on local devolution doesn't run counter to what we must do on planning law. And it needs...
He's like, fucking hell, when can I just get back in and do what needs to be done? This is, you know, he is pretty angry that he's like, he, you know, we joke about him being powerful and so on, but he's seeing that the things that need to be done aren't being done. And if they're, from a practical point of view, if they are not done, then the plan that they've got cannot happen, essentially.
Our political debate to change radically. The paradox of 21st century politics is at the very time when 20th century ideology of left versus right has never been less relevant, our main political parties became bedeviled by it.
Yeah, there is a kind of truth that left and right is no longer relevant, but not for the reasons that he thinks. Tony Blair's saying that because he's like, well, these things that I'm stating are fact, and it's just a scientific truth that all of these things need to be done. So I'm speaking from the neutral point of view of just pure practicality. That's his view, which is beyond left and right in his framing. You know, the reasons that we would say left and right no longer matter are completely different. I would say left and right no longer matter because we're just against these fuckers. You know, we're against these global controllers, as Sargon calls them. So, it's a different frame, but in a strange way, Blair also sees through ideological bullshit on both sides and cuts to the heart of the matter. But I want the people watching this to cut to the heart of the matter and see who the real enemies are here. It's literally, you're looking at him here. These are the people to keep an eye on, not the day-to-day bickering back and forth between Boris Johnson and Keir Starmer or whatever bullshit is going on Twitter. This is the stuff that matters right here. He's got his eye on it all the time. We should also.
The Conservative Party deserted their traditional role as high priests of pragmatic change and turned Thatcherism into a cult. The Labour Party went through the catastrophe of the Corbyn era, from which, under Keir Starmer's determined leadership, it is thankfully emerging with renewed vigour, a talented front bench, as Rachel Reeves shows again today, and her speech underlines, And
when he looked at Rachel Reed there was a hint of the Palpatine with the young Anakin there. Did you see that?
The Labour Party has recovered a healthy desire to erase the memory of four successive defeats. It could provide the plan the country needs. As Keir himself acknowledges, this is indeed the Labour Party challenge for 2022. However, for years, policy for both parties, in the sense of a relentless search for the right answer, which, as I discovered in government, is ultimately all that matters, that was abandoned. Politics became all about politics, not about ideas. I understand completely the rage against what happened.
Now, one of the things I talk about in Foundations of Politics are four liberal myths, okay? But one of the ways I would characterize liberal thinking is this idea that you can somehow escape from politics, that the realm of the political is somehow separate from the economy, from technology, from the state, from, you know, institutions, etc. And Blair is tapping into that liberal myth right here, that this idea that you can just escape the political. Listen to what you just said. You know, politicians, like political parties, have like been doing politics instead of like doing the stuff I want them to do, as if what he wants to do, as if this plan that he's talking about is in some way non-political or post-political. You know, this is liberal framing where you frame what they want to do as a neutral, scientific, medicalized, whatever you want to call it. It's this neutral lens masking the actual political intent behind what he wants to do. So Blair always presents himself as being somehow beyond politics, like beyond left and right, beyond, you know, mere politics. Now, in a sense, he's right, because there's not this kind of nonsense back and forth show that you'll see in the Houses of Parliament, you know, in the House of Commons or whatever, which is often like ephemera. He's right about that aspect of it. But the deeper metapolitical point is that he's wrong that his position is somehow non-political. His position is political. It's very political. It might not be conventionally left or right, but he's still like, he has still got a plan and an agenda which affect everybody's life. And he presents it as if there's no choice. There is a choice. We don't have to do this stupid fucking plan that he's talking about. We don't have to do it. There are choices to be made. But, you know, him and his friends have decided this is the way things are going to go. So, you know.
In Downing Street during lockdown and how the country feels.
And maybe people in the chat saying, literally what Blair is saying is, listen, let's not debate and argue about what needs to be done. We've decided what needs to be done. So fucking put your stupid politics away and put our policies in place. That's basically what he's saying in a nutshell. But anyway, let's carry on.
Maybe Boris Johnson goes and maybe he doesn't. But the real problem for Britain is the absence of a government plan for Britain's future. The NHS will soon eat up over 40% of day-to-day spending on public services. At least when we put health spending up to the European average in the early years of this century, we accompanied it by far-reaching reforms, which took NHS satisfaction levels to the highest they'd ever been.
Can I just tell you what Tony Blair's version of reform is, by the way? Because this is obscured, okay? What Tony Blair did, and Thatcher did this before, but Blair was like big on it, is that they ostensibly, how can I say, like liberalize or denationalize bits of the apparatus and parcel them out to contractors. That's what he did in NHS and social services and mental health and, you know, prisons. And they literally just contract it out to some company who wins a contract and does it on the government's behalf. And so the government basically gets to dodge accountability because now it's some company doing it. And they get to get the budget off the government books, like the day-to-day running budget. It looks smaller if some company is doing it over there. Okay. But remember, in the kind of neoliberal apparatus or the managerial state that we talk about, there is no real separation between state and corporation. So all they're doing is they're moving it from one bit of the apparatus that the public can see to another bit of the apparatus that the public cannot see because it's quote unquote private. It's technically private, but in actuality, they're just performing the same public service that would have been done by something that was on the government books. So that was the Blair special. Get the figures off the government books. You know, when he says reform, that's what he means every time. Make it, in the language of Klaus Schwab, a public-private partnership. Yeah, that's the World Economic Forum lingo. It's a public-private partnership. That's what Blair wants all the time, with massive, massive kind of contracts for managerial advisors at every step of the chain. Right? I mean, do you remember the Millennium Dome? That was a Blair special. You know, executive consultants left, right, and center, each having a piece of the pie. But that, right, all of those little boondoggle contracts in the chain, when you set up the Blair special, on paper, boosts GDP. It makes GDP look higher. It makes the economy look like it's going somewhere because it's like bullshit jobs for all these people, you know, management consultants at every part. Anyway, let's carry on.
But today, though the staff continue to perform miracles, the service, especially post-COVID, is too often unacceptably poor. There are those within the NHS leading the way on reform, using technology to transform the service, thinking imaginatively about the future. We need to empower them. Through advances in medical science, the use of data, making systems properly interoperable.
Here we go. This is, we're zeroing in now on the thing that Morgoth keeps on talking about. The digital ID, something Blair's wanted for years. He's going to try to use the NHS as the pretext to get this into the British system.
And artificial intelligence, we can transform the patient experience and reduce cost. And Lord Darzi himself has estimated that the NHS could save £12.5 billion by use of AI in eliminating.
And do you remember years ago, I always used to say that the NHS would be the way that Britain is turned into a communist state, you know, over time, just due to the fact that it's just inescapable, you know, massive black hole. But it's also the pretext by which you can bring in this creeping totalitarianism. We've already seen it massively over the COVID era. And now Blair wants to consolidate that by using a quote data, and it will be sold to you as convenience. It will be convenience first of all. You know, oh, it's quicker rather than go and see your doctor. Go on this app instead. You know, consult the virtual doctor or whatever. That's what it will be. And most people, you know, will take convenience when it's offered, but then they've got a way of tracking everything that you're doing.
Routine and administrative tasks alone. But all of this requires organizing together with major workforce reform. The point is, we can't go on as we are, even in an area as politically delicate as the NHS. And you could make this case across the whole of public policy. We need to apply technology to areas like crime and immigration, where the only sensible way of preventing illegal immigration is a system of digital identity.
Right, look at this. Look at the Blair game. He knows the right won't like this. You know, the sorts of people who march against lockdown won't like this. How can we sell it to them? Illegal immigration. This will be the angle. If we can bring in digital ID, it will prevent illegal immigration. And that's how you sell it to the Daily Mail. That's how you sell it to the Sun. That's the way to do it, Boris. This is, I mean, he's giving like amazing Machiavellian advice to the government here. If only they would take it.
We need to shift tax from labor and capital, especially post-Brexit, find other sources of revenue so that our tax system is not colliding with our competitiveness, and to rethink pensions for the next generation, where apart from the burgeoning cost, the circumstances of retirement will be completely different in the next generation from today. Fuel duty will probably have to be...
As if anybody watching this show is going to get a pension. Anyway, let's carry on.
...replaced by some form of road pricing. And the point is, this list is not exhaustive, but not a single thing we need to do to turn our fortunes around will come without political pain. And our politics show few, if any, signs of preparedness to tolerate that pain. Just remember the Thatcher economic reforms caused huge public discontent. At times, by the way, the Tories were third in the polls. The country was bitterly divided. Likewise, under New Labour, the changes to public services, to law and order.
He's saying you need to do unpopular things in power. You need to just fucking bite the bullet. Fuck the public. Fuck the public. Just do it. Just do it. This is what he's saying. Now, there is some truth to this, though. Sometimes when you're in government, you have to do deeply unpopular things out of necessity. I'm not convinced that the things that he is talking about are the necessities that he claims. It's very debatable, but he is correct on the basic principle that the tall and short of it is, like, fuck democracy. The rulers need to rule, and all of this, like, in a way, Boris is very weak. He's always U-turning. He's always looking at polls. He's always reacting to what the public want and so on. And this is, like, from a pure Machiavellian point of view, it's shit. Like, he needs to lead. And to lead, you need to do things that are deeply unpopular, which Boris just always pussies away from. So, and he's right. When the history books are written, people will look back and we'll be like, who are the good leaders that Britain had? Like, who are the best prime ministers? And it'll be the ones who are unpopular. Like, i.e., they won elections like Thatcher and Blair, but they also did things that the public hated at the time, for better or for worse. That is leadership. So he's right about this.
Redistribution of wealth, reforms like the minimum wage, they were all heavily contested at the time. And that was when the economy was strong. Meeting the challenge of these three revolutions is infinitely more difficult than any of that, and at a time when the economy is still recovering from COVID. It means reorganization of a fundamental nature in the way that government works, bringing in the brightest and best innovators from outside government, and a mobilization of talent and resource.
More managers required, more technical expertise required, more elites required, that do not have the taint of stupid party politics to affect what they want to do. This is pure, it's absolute pure managerialism, Blair's vision of how things should work. It's quite remarkable, really.
We're nowhere near achieving. And I don't think it can be done unless politicians work across traditional party lines to create a plan that is sustainable over at least a decade.
Can I just mention something as well here, right? I don't know how long we've been going. Like, he's been going about 20 minutes or so here. Things that Blair hasn't mentioned once, right? Fucking, like, racial justice, woke agenda, sexism, white... the threat posed by white nationalists, BLM, none of these culture war talking points enter into the Blair lexicon whatsoever. This is a pure technocratic vision of the future and what needs to be done and what isn't being done by our stupid, current leaders who are obsessed with ephemera. This is the key takeaway of this. Of this vision from Blair, and it's something to bear in mind it is something to bear in mind that they don't speak in the, like, Blair is not speaking the same language as the AOC here. They don't speak in that language. This is a different level of elite here. They see all that other stuff as like ephemera, basically. So,
because reforms as far-reaching and difficult as these require consistency of policy over time, even through a change of government. So, my institute, over these next months, will set out in a series of papers and seminars with a global as well as national perspective, at least the principles of this new policy agenda.
But basically, we're going to fucking write the policies. Me and my team are going to write the policies. We're going to stick it on the UK Cabinet Office's table, and they are going to sign off on it. That's what he wants. In an ideal world, the government would just take over Tony Blair Institute's policies wholesale, and he will rely on their natural passivity and laziness in order to enact that agenda, because that's what they rely on. You know, the principle of power is the tightly organized minority elite. And the Tony Blair Institute, I'm afraid to say, is more organized, more, they've got their eye more on the ball, they think more in the strategic way than anyone in the two major parties at the moment, which is why these guys seem like they're running the show. Now, it's clear that they're not getting all their own way from this speech. It's clear that the Tories are always hesitant and they're always not quite playing ball. But the fact of the matter is, these guys will put the work in, they will write the policies, and then it will be like, well, there it is. What's your plan, Boris? What's your plan, Michael Gove? Oh, shit, we haven't got one. Should we just use Blair's? Yeah, all right then. And that's how it goes so many times. These guys stay up 24-7 thinking about these things, whereas Boris stays up 24-7 thinking about, oh, shit, look at that poll. Look at that news headline. Oh, shit, another person's died of COVID. Oh, no, you know, it's like the thick of it in the, you know, Tory HQ. Whereas this dude and his team are thinking just about these top-level real things all the time. This is like a structural issue within liberal democracy and within our current system. And it's a problem because Boris kind of lost his operator like this. You know, Dominic Cummings was a guy like this, a kind of pure technocrat, if you want. But he's gone now. Like, he was fired. I don't know who's there instead. But, you know, it's obviously a shit show in Tory HQ compared to, you know, how things are working in this NGO.
Then the Britain Project, it's a group working across party lines, though headed by a Liberal Democrat, Monica Harding. It will organise a conference in May. And we want this conference to be an opportunity for people to come together and set out a broad direction for the future of Britain.
In other words, there's a parallel government in this country where we're just going to fucking plan what globalists want to do in place of the main political parties who are too busy playing with their dicks. That's basically what you're saying. And it's going to be headed by the Lib Dems, who are deeply unpopular and nobody cares about. It's very interesting indeed.
Participating should leave politics and ideology at the door. Our task is practical understanding of how the world is changing and what that means for what works to make our country stronger, fairer, and more prosperous. The choices will be hard. Old ways, old interests, old thinking don't go gently. But neither should a country, especially one with such a proud history as ours, slip gently into a lower league without a strenuous effort, at least, to prevent it. Yet without a radical change.
Note the little manipulative touch of patriotism that you mixed in there. You know, history with a country with a history as proud of ours. You know, what is he appealing to there? Who is he appealing to? But you know that there will have been people in that room who, you know, he intended that for.
in the governing of the country and its politics, this is where we're headed. And this is the debate, in my view, that Britain needs. Thank you.
All right, so there he was. Now, there is an interview with Aman Paul from CNN, which I'm going to right now. I don't know. I haven't cleared this with CNN. So if the stream dies, you'll know that CNN don't want this. Don't want this on YouTube. But I actually took it directly from the CNN website. I found a way of downloading it, and we're going to watch it together. If CNN take the stream down, then if it's taken down in real time, stay there, okay? Stay there, because it will come back. And I won't be able to finish it, but we'll do super chats if CNN, you know, decide to kind of do a live thing. But let's see. Here is... Oh, hold on. Having trouble sharing the video. What's wrong with the video? Let me try again. Oh, the file is invalid. Hold on a second. Let me just convert it. It's a shorter name, maybe. Hold on. Struggling to pay the clip. Let's try that. See if it doesn't. I may need to convert the file a second into a smaller format. Yeah. Okay. Let me just convert it. This won't take long. Yeah. 800 viewers is quite a lot for The Deepest Lore, but you know, Tony Blair. I would say that I am the premier watcher of Tony Blair on YouTube. So I'm not surprised that quite a lot of people are tuning in for this. Let me just hold on a second. Let me just try to convert this file so that the StreamYards thing actually plays it. While we're waiting, I'll do some super chats. Years the Eunuch says, "I require evidence that Blair is not the Antichrist. Until then, I maintain that he is. I'm afraid I cannot provide evidence that Blair is not the Antichrist because." He really is. I mean, if there's ever a man with a Faustian pact, who's made a kind of a deal with the devil, is this dude. You can see it in his face. Son of Tiamat says, Why do Britbongs insist on pronouncing four syllable words with only three? It hurts my American ears. Captain Smith, I don't know, what you'd have to give me an example, Son of Tiamat. Captain Smith says, do you think the backlash to his knighthood has killed any hope of Tony returning to electoral politics? Maybe that's why he looks a bit down. I do think that the fact that there were over a million signatories to that petition against his knighthood has killed any chance of his personal return to frontline politics. But he continues to just backseat drive, as we're seeing here. Like, he's still... As far as I'm concerned, he's still the most important person in British politics. Just listen to the way he talks. None of our current leaders talk like this. He is the only person who is regularly on television who talks like an actual leader. And don't get me wrong, we all hate him. We all see the darkness of his vision. But at least he is outlining what it is the elites want to do. In my view, he's a different caliber. He's a different caliber of operator to any of the politicians who are currently there at the minute. James Espinosa says, on the subject of digital ID, don't forget you are now auto-enrolled for organ donation upon death. They already de facto own your organs. I didn't know that. When did they pull that one? I was never told about this. So there we go. Now let's see if my converted video. Oh, why is it saying it's going to take that long to? Hold on a minute. saying it's going to take 22 minutes to convert the file. Oh, blimmin' heck. Hold on, I'll cancel that. Abort. Let me see if I can find a better format for it. What happens if I want to turn it into an AVI, for example? Will it do it quicker then? Okay, I reckon they'll do it in 6 minutes. Okay, so let me just read some more chat. Why this is not working, I don't know. I'll try it again. I've got another way. Hold on a minute. I've got another way to do it. Let's do it another way. I've just thought of this. I can play it in my browser. Let me play it in my browser like this. What's the issue? Why isn't it playing it? Something weird about this file. It's just not playing anything. Open with Google Chrome. Some reason it's not playing. Maybe I'll just find it on CNN. Hold on. Tony Blair, Amanda Paul, CNN interview. I'll just play it from the CNN website. How about that? Okay, I found it. More than one way is to skin a cat, eh? Okay, let's do this.
Prime Minister, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
So you have talked about the future of Britain basically revolving around three revolutions: Brexit, technology, and climate. Can you sum up what you mean and what you mean by revolutions?
So we're living through a period of time in the UK when you have these massive changes happening. Brexit, you know, the decision's over, whether it's right or wrong, that's done with. But it's a decision of consequence because half of our trade is with Europe. It's part of our continent. You know, we can change our politics in respect of Europe. We can't change our interests or geography. So Brexit is a huge change. We don't have a plan to deal with it. Secondly, you've got...
They would say you do have a plan, or they have a plan, but you say they don't.
Well, they don't really. No, we don't have a new trade relationship in place with Europe. We haven't decided what areas we want to concentrate upon in Europe. Our relationship with Europe at the moment is very scratchy and difficult. We haven't resolved even Northern Ireland. So I don't think they do have a plan for Brexit. Then you've got a climate ambition that's enormous. It's the right ambition, but... You know, just to give you an example, it means we're going to have to quadruple the rate at which we build renewable energy.
Now, let me just say here, notice how this 15-minute interview with Chris, with Amanda Poor on CNN is not really an interview. It's a way of Blair getting the key bullet points of his speech onto a major MSN platform, i.e. through this interview on American TV. So he's getting his major talking points out there. And this essentially is a puff piece. It's a puff piece by CNN promoting like Blair. This is what we're watching. So, you know, the idea that it's an interview or that there's anything like adversarial about the relationship between Amanda Poor and Blair is a complete fiction, obviously. Anyway, let's continue.
In the UK, you're going to be changing all the fossil fuel cars into electric vehicles, changing all the gas boilers with heat pumps. This is massive. We have a plan there, but I don't think it's nearly adequate. And then you've got the technology revolution, which is going to change everything in our world. and where the real political debate should be, not between old style left and right, but how do you harness this revolution to reform things like healthcare, education, law and order.
Note, by the way, how much better the cameras make him look than in the recording of that speech that we just saw. I can't look how much shinier Blair is when he's on TV. It's quite remarkable.
Fence the whole works, never mind how business operates. So my point is, you've got three revolutions, no plan for the future. For Britain, what this means is, if we don't get such a plan and pursue it, we're going to relegate ourselves from the Premier League of countries.
And you have said there's no cause for pessimism, although you do sound right now pessimistic, but there is an urgent need for realism in the face of the three revolutions. Without a...
Note the constant framing of himself as the realist, as the non-ideological actor, as the pragmatist, as somebody who's just speaking for technology and science and nothing else. It's a very interesting, attempt to mask politics behind this neutral language, and it's something that these people constantly do that you need to know how to pass.
Radical shift in policy. We face a steady, inexorable compound decline similar to back in the 60s and 70s. We're relegating ourselves to a league which is poorer, less prosperous, and less powerful. That, of course, goes right against the grain of the Boris Johnson government, which says, you know, we're global Britain, we've got the sunny uplands, we've shown that, I mean, they claim that they've shown the economy has rebounded to pre-COVID levels, and they're doing very nicely, thank you very much.
I think that would not be the experience of most people. We're about to face tax rises. We've got rising energy bills. The best estimate is that our trend growth is around about 1.7% for the next years. I mean, during the early part of the century when I was in office, it was 2.3% or more. If you look at where we are today, the disruption to our trading relationship, the fact that although we've got an institutionally strong relationship with America, I don't think politically our relationship with America is very strong anymore. And of course, our relationship with Europe's pretty much in breakdown. So you look at it from a power point of view or a living standards point of view. Now, we do have strengths. I mean, it's not impossible to turn this around. We've got great technology in the UK, great life sciences. We're leaders in climate technology. We've got the City of London.
Leaders in climate technology. Way. Woo!
And we've got wonderful universities, our culture, our language. You know, there's lots to be proud of and optimistic about, but it needs government to be organized. And our politics today has, at least until very recently with the changes in the Labour Party, given me more cause for optimism. But up to now, our politics has just been about politics and bitter divisions in right and left, which don't correspond to the needs.
Imagine politics being about politics, as we've discussed already.
World today, which is, you know, the solutions you require are practical. And at the very point in time when we need practical solutions, both main parties went ideological.
This is very similar to what's happening in the United States and in many of the Western Alliance countries, this deep ideological division or political division between right and left, and ne'er the twain shall meet, and particularly when it comes to making serious policy decisions for the future of their countries. In this country, where you were Prime Minister before, your Labour Party is now saying Johnson is no longer fit to lead. Obviously, this is because of Partygate, which the whole world has now clocked onto Prime Minister's questions. They've seen him try to answer them.
Notice, by the way, this is very interesting because in his speech, Blair didn't mention any of this BS whatsoever. CNN, with their kind of bullshit MSM frame, are coming in and talking about Partygate. Blair does not care about this. He doesn't want to talk about fucking Partygate. He wants to talk about what needs to be done.
Is he no longer fit to lead? And can you actually have what you're proposing with a mortally wounded prime minister?
You know, I always say to people, it's not my job to get into whether the prime minister should stay or go. You know, I've been prime minister myself. I don't call upon my successors to resign. So I'll leave all that to those who are in the front line of politics. But what I...
Yeah, just not important. Just not fucking important, Christine. get on message, bitch.
I do think is this, that if the government doesn't create such a plan for the future, and our politics is incapable of producing one, we're in trouble. Now, I think, you know, what's changed in British politics, frankly, over the last months, is that the Labour Party, under its new leadership, has moved much closer back to the centre. And that's in line with a lot of what's happening in Europe. I mean, Europe today, in Germany, you know, Olaf Scholz is in many ways seen as the successor to Angela Merkel, even if he's not the same political party.
See, this is mental, right? Everything's moving back to the centre. Are the public moving back to the centre? Like the power bases, the politics is moving back to the centre. But is that what people want? Is that what people are voting for? It's not. It's what the elites have decided they want to go back to the centre because that's where they were happy. I agree with Nick. You know, they wanted it where it was Cameron, Brown, Nick Clegg, you know, three versions of Tony Blair, basically. That's what they want. You know, your choice is Tony Blair, or Tony Blair. Your choice is you do this globalist, technocratic, global government stuff that I want you to do, or get out of the kitchen, basically. That's what he's saying. You know, all of this politics is a distraction from what we want to do. This is the central message of, Blair.
President Macron's still in a strong position in France. Italy, of all the European countries, is probably the one that is regarded as making a lot of progress now, particularly over the last few years, with essentially a technocratic government. So there's some signs and
just fucking open, just mask off, like fuck Salvini, fuck Five Star, fuck what the Italian public want. You know, we will install a technocratic government and Italy will play ball. It's funny, his CNN performance is a lot more mask off than his speech, believe it or not.
COVID also, I think, is producing some signs amongst the public that what they respect is competent government.
Partygate in the gardens of Downing Street. You referred a little bit to the crisis in your speech. I mean, that's pretty bad. Do you agree?
Yeah, no, it should never have happened. And it was, people are justifiably outraged by it. Now, how exactly it all turns out politically, that's another matter. But no, the problem was that everyone was suffering during lockdown. And, you know, it was an extraordinary thing to do. But, yeah, there it is.
Can I ask you about COVID? Because here in this country, it looks from the government's point of view as if the peak has been reached, it's going down, and they have announced, Boris Johnson has announced, basically all restrictions are going to be...
Fucking hell, is he going to bring out the bloody Palpatine lightning? Be careful, Christine.
Lifted in the next days and then in the next few weeks. Is that a good thing? I mean, they have had a very successful vaccine and boosting program.
The general direction... Yes, I mean, the timing's a little politically convenient, let's say, but leave that aside. No, the general direction is fine. I think if Omicron is the worst it gets, we'll get through it.
Because America is literally sinking in malaise over this. And President Biden, on the one-year anniversary of his inauguration, is facing terrible poll ratings, mostly around the perception that he can't get a grip, actually, on COVID, and of course, inflation and other stuff.
But you still, I think, in America, there's still a significant number of people not vaccinated. I mean, that's, it's an indicator of how broken politics has been, that the issue of vaccination should become political. I mean, it's just a question of...
How could it ever not be political? Just think about what he said. How could the government forcing you to put a foreign object in your arm ever not be political? And yet, in the warped vision of Tony Blair, it's a non-ideological, non-political matter of science. And if a technocratic elite tells you to put the jab in your arm, you best do it. And it's not a left or a right issue. It's not a matter of right or wrong. It's a matter of neutral scientific fact. And this is the way these people want to rule. Because Tony says so.
Science. And by the way, you look at the studies around the world, the evidence for getting vaccinated is utterly overwhelming. I mean, it is the thing that saves you as an individual, prevents you from spreading the disease.
It's not a left or right thing. It's not a political thing. It's not an ideological matter. You know, it's non-political. And this, as I was saying earlier on, is the great liberal myth that you can somehow divorce politics from other areas of life, that there is somehow no politics in the law, that there is no politics in the state, that there isn't, you know, the neutral civil service state, that there is no politics in medicine or in science. And of course, we know that to be a myth. We know that to be untrue. And yet, this is what Blair is always leaning into. And what I find interesting is that I get the impression that this does not wash with the public anymore, left or right. But I could be wrong.
Disease not as nearly as much as otherwise, and of course protects your healthcare system because otherwise it gets overwhelmed. So it's a curious thing how this ever became political, but it's an indicator of the thing that I'm talking about, which is the state of Western politics.
So you were one of the first, if not the first, British public official to suggest about a year or so ago, when it was quite clear that we didn't have enough vaccines to meet the initial 3-week gap and then 4-week gap. You said vaccinate everybody once, and then we'll figure out the second vaccines. Do you feel somewhat vindicated by that?
Yeah, I think in the end it was the sensible policy, particularly with us using AstraZeneca.
Isn't it interesting that Tony Blair was one of the first public officials to say that, and then that is exactly what happened? Isn't that interesting? Nobody sees the causal relationship between those two things. And yet, here we are.
Because it's clear that a 3-month gap between first and second dose is probably optimal. But now you've got the boosters. I think the more shocking thing for me...
Yeah, and it's worth mentioning that she called him a public official. Blair has not been in office in any capacity since 2007, 2008. He's literally a non-government actor. He is literally just a kind of pundit, basically, but it's obvious that he's a lot more than that. So there was a bit of a slip from Emma and Paul.
This is where the world's got to position itself differently for the future, is that we didn't, at an early stage, cooperate globally in ensuring we had enough vaccine for the world. Now, we will have enough vaccine this year. And now the problem for the world is absorption capacity and overcoming vaccine hesitancy.
So talk to me a little bit about cooperation and coalitions, because you were, you know, involved in exactly that kind of leadership with the US alliance and the rest during the 90s and the 2000s when you were prime minister. Some of it went...
Yeah, I have fucking invented triangulation, bitch.
Right, some of it didn't go right. But that seems to be very much lacking right now. I mean, it started, I guess, with President Trump pulling out of things like the WHO right in the middle of this pandemic and, you know, the Iran nuclear deal, climate and the like. How desperately obvious is the fact that there is no real coalition to fix really broad global problems right now?
Look how softball this interview as well. Like, the CNN is just like, yeah, like, I mean, she might as well be, but she might as well be like, you know, on her knees here. Like, come on, Tony, tell me about your great technocratic, non-governmental, non-political, fucking technocratic coalition government that you want to bring in, because that's what we want, isn't it? That's what we want at CNN. Fuck all this politics stuff, because we can't win political battles. We can't actually win debates. What we need to do is bypass debates, bypass the need for, you know, this is one of the greatest tricks that these people have done, is to present something as already having been decided. We are past the point of conversation. Note, with the climate change stuff, it wasn't that they ever had a debate and won. They just acted as if the issue was decided already. And that's what they do. That's what they've done for decades now. I tell you who's very good on that particular issue is Gottfried in After Liberalism and his follow-up book, Multiculturalism and the Politics of Guilt. It's this very clever way of just simply bypassing the discussion. And that's what Blair wants to do. He doesn't want to have a debate or to convince anyone. They've decided what they're doing. Just fucking accept it. Stop being so hesitant. We don't want vaccine hesitancy. We don't want climate hesitancy. We don't want hesitancy on anything. Stop resisting what we want to do. You're being political.
think it's a curious thing that's happened, which is that people got into the way of thinking that if you were in favor of global cooperation, it meant you were putting someone else before your own people. And so this idea of my country first became, you know, a common theme of Western politics. But in the end, the reason why you're in favor of cooperation is enlightened self-interest. It's not because you want to put someone else before you. I mean, if you cooperate on vaccines.
Enlightened self-interest. It's enlightened self-interest to cooperate across ideological lines to do the things that Tony Blair wants you to do. Do you hear that, Morgoth? You get that digital ID, mate. Take the jab because it's enlightened self-interest.
It's more vaccine for everyone. If you don't vaccinate the world, the disease keeps mutating and it can come back and affect your own people. If you're not going to cooperate on climate change, you're all going to suffer. So I hope
people saying that he's a liar and a snake, like I think he's been doing this for so long that he just thinks like this. Like, it's just, he doesn't even have to try. He believes this shit himself. I'm convinced of it. Like, I don't think he's lying. That's why he's quite, you know, he can be quite convincing because he believes it himself. He believes all this bollocks.
One of the things that comes out of COVID is that people do understand the need for that global cooperation, but it's, you know, there's so much more we could do to get things right. And I'm worried about the future because, you know, my institute's put forward a series of
people are saying that he's openly threatening us. And yeah, that is also the case. Like, the thing is that it's not like there's not that much mask here. I mean, he's just like, since he's not actually in government, he doesn't have to play like optics anymore. Like, he knows like a million people hate him already. So he's just like, fuck it. I'm just going to, all of these interviews, all of these speeches are for elites to get their head around. Like, he is talking directly to people in the civil service, people in the managerial elites around the world, but especially in Britain. Like, this is his target audience. This is why he does these interviews and these speeches. He's trying to get it on the radar of those people who need to put it into practice. Since Boris is not doing what he wants them to do, he is, as much as he can, like, literally just trying to bypass the political process and the democratic process to get these things done that he needs to do. Otherwise, his masters will be displeased, and he can't have that.
Detailed plans for how you cooperate on global pandemics for the future, but you really need to get that organized because it will happen, and you know, we should just learn from the past.
You haven't, in your speech, The Future of Britain, you haven't really focused on foreign policy per se, other than, you know, relations with Europe and Brexit. But you have seen two big issues, you know, flare up recently, and you were critical about the haphazard pullout from Afghanistan. That seemed the opposite of a coalition, of talking to the allies Biden had promoted, you know, America is back, and it was a disaster. And you spoke very harshly about it at the time. Are you still, I mean, however many months later, do you still think that it was the wrong thing to do?
I do. I'm afraid there's no way out of that. I think it's what's happened is very tragic. I hope we can repair it over time.
You don't look too optimistic on that. I wonder if you're...
I mean, again, you can see that you always know when he's displeased.
More optimistic on what's happening between NATO and Russia. So Russia yesterday, the main negotiator and deputy foreign minister Ryabkov said, we do not want and we will not, and he used all these words, invade, attack, strike, whatever, he said, Ukraine. Do you buy that? He's the spokesman for Putin on this issue. Do you buy that?
CNN, of course, very big on Russia. They love Russia on over on liberal MSM in America. They love this. So let's see what Blair has to say.
I mean, the fact is their actions will be what counts. And some of their words, by the way, have been extremely bellicose mm-hmm. and aggressive. But we just got to go back to what's happening here. Ukraine is a country on the borders of Europe, part of the larger European space. And it's being said that they're not free to determine their own future. I mean, this is not about them making up their minds that they want to go with Russia or want to go with the West. This is about the present Russian leadership saying to them, it doesn't matter what you decide, you're with us, and we'll force you to be if you don't like it.
It's exactly the opposite, by the way. The truth is exactly the opposite of what he's just said. And when you see the NGO-funded protests and stuff there, it's exactly the opposite of what he's talking about. Notice, by the way, that he wasn't prepared to talk about Ukraine and Russia on here, but he was just effortlessly able to talk exactly, he exactly knew the global homo line on this straight away. Because as we've seen on so many streams, he has a finger in every fucking pie.
I don't see how Europe accepts that. So I think the biggest risk is that Russia misunderstands that any form of attempt to go into Ukraine to launch an attack on Ukraine would be met, I think, with a large and unified Western response. I mean, I know people talk about the divisions and so on, but the European leaders I'm talking to, they're not really divided on this.
No, it does seem...
Why is he talking to European leaders? If I was the CNN anchor, I'd be like, Tony, you have not been the prime minister for 14 years. Why exactly do you still speak to European leaders? Like, in what capacity do you speak to them? But of course, this is a softball interview, which is a puff piece for Tony Blair. So he's never going to get that question.
It seems actually that this is a case of real unity from the US, Europe, and all those dealing with Russia. And as you say, many have suggested that that's the only way to tell Putin which way you'll think and are going to act. Therefore, were you, like others, concerned about what President Biden said last night at his press conference? And let me just quote, "Russia will be held accountable, and it depends on what it does. It's one thing if it's a minor incursion, and we in NATO end up having to fight about what to do and what not to do, etc." And then he basically also said he thinks Putin will have to do something. He will do some invading. So do you think the White House has clarified, very strict position from the White House, but the Ukrainians are pretty upset about it. They say, he gave a little bit of a green light there for even a mini invasion.
I don't think he did, though, really. And I'm sure that any form of military incursion is going to be a huge problem for the West. And Russia's got to think seriously about what its own long-term interests are. You know, remember, the Russian economy is, two-thirds the size of the UK or Italy's economy. The sensible thing would be for them to focus on how they build economic strength, the living standards of their people. I mean, no one seriously believes that Ukraine joining NATO is on the near-term agenda. So there's not really there's no justification
for it. I mean, hold him to that. Or just watch this space.
And which makes some people think, well, maybe it's to do with the internal politics of Russia. But for whatever reason, the one thing I am sure about is that the response...
Also, the amazing answer, Biden didn't really mean that. So, he didn't mean it. So... this is the official line. Listen to me, I'm not senile.
The response of the West would be very big, and I believe it will be united.
Can I ask you what you feel about being knighted, Sir Tony? And what do you feel about, the million signatures against your knighthood?
You know, this is an honor bestowed by the Queen. It's in her personal gift. And as I've said to people, I take it as something not just, it's not for me as a person, but for me as the leader of a government that made a lot of changes in the country and governed I was Prime Minister for 10 years. So, and it's a traditional thing for Prime Ministers to have. And of course, if you're in politics today, you're going to have people who are strongly opposed. I understand that, but if you don't want criticism today in public life, you should steer clear of it.
So there you go. Exactly as he said in his speech, you have to do unpopular things or when you're in power. Look at that face.
Tony Blair, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'll just... all right. Thanks a lot for that. ladies and gentlemen. Let's see if there's been any more last minute super chats and we'll get out of here. Nice and short, deepest lore today. There's been a couple more from the Entropy. Years the Eunuch says that that interview was peak technocrat. He speaks as if he already owns us, not like a parent, but like a mad scientist who wants his unruly lab rats to behave so the experiment can continue. Evil. Yeah, that's exactly his tone. As someone was pointing out in the chat, it's very interesting, isn't it, that when it's Ukraine, it's all about self-determination. Now it's important what the people want. But when it's what to do in Britain, it's like bypass the public, bypass the official procedures, bypass the political system, like the political back and forth, just to get done what needs to be done in a purely technocratic managerial way. So, liberal democracy is literally just whatever these people want. You know, anything they want is liberal democracy. Anything they don't want is autocratic or dictatorial or fascist. There's a very good, I mentioned Gottfried. He wrote two books, Fascism, the Career of a Concept, and his latest one is Anti-Fascism. And he talks, he analyzes this issue of how these people just like, they basically just redefine terms to suit their own agendas. Despite the fact that there's absolutely no relationship between the words liberal and democracy and what they're doing. In fact, in many cases, it is the exact opposite of what they do. Like he talked about in Italy, right? The Italian public, I think Salvini has been like 30% plus in the polls, the most popular politician in Italy for the past like 3 years or the past 2 years at the very least. And yet he was just thrilled about the fact that a technocratic government has been installed in Italy and is just doing what they want. They don't care about elections. They don't care about democracy. And they also don't care about liberalism. Koulian says, remember that Lord Urquhart left Twitter because he was so demoralized over Omicron and thought impending doom was about to incur. It's so funny now, but I bet he still trusts the experts. Oh yeah, I mean, I so thoroughly wrecked the Tory boys that I still live rent free in their heads every single day, I'm sure. All right, thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Oh yeah, oh, hold on, there's been more super chats I've just spotted. John Post says, do you think the globalists' increased efforts to dilute the West is a result of their failure to dilute the Muslim world with that project on hold? I mean, it's certainly related to their inability to install liberal democracy in you know, Islamo-fascist states, you know, to use the old parlance of neocons. But also, I think there's a certain degree to which we have to say it looks deliberate as well. It looks like they deliberately wanted mass immigrants to arrive in the country. It was Blair's explicit plan. Note, by the way, he didn't mention immigration once in any of his, you know, in almost an hour of footage of Blair. He didn't touch any of those things because he is singularly focused on the things that on these three objectives that he kept on talking about over and over again. And the biggest one is the Agenda 2030. Sam Peter says, I don't know about Blair Antichrist. Catholic esoteric tradition that it is a pre-existing big good guy has to be swept away so the Antichrist can take power. And I'm not seeing a good guy, Catchicon restrainer, anywhere. I don't see any good guys on the horizon either. Nathan CJ Hood says, when they collectivize food, this will be their there will be holodomors. That's a frightening thought, Nathan. And I really think that the farm detail that we've been covering and that we'll talk about next week on the Beyond Meat show is going to be an increasing and creeping agenda in the next few years that we're going to have to pay much closer attention to. before it becomes literally illegal to question, as I'm sure that will be down the line. You know, it will, first of all, will be illegal to question climate change. Then it will be illegal to question, like, you know, you'll probably get like state mandated beyond meat on certain days and rations and things like this. I'm sure of it. Unless, of course, they reverse course or get, you know, populists somehow find a way to oust them, which could still happen. Yosef Talway says they spent a decade importing millions of cheap wage slaves, and now in less than 10 years they want to get rid of all these jobs. Surely it would be fertile ground for the far right and Islamists. I mean, they have to fear economic downturn more than anything else, because as long as everybody's comfortable, you know, they can kind of get away with the breads and the circuses. Once either the bread or the circuses stop, people have nothing else, they'll start looking at who the real enemy is. And they know, the people down on the streets know, that the real enemy isn't the fucking foot soldier in BLM. It's not the black guy next door. It's not the white guy next door. It's not the Muslim, in the neighborhood, across from yours. It's the elites who have created these situations. Deep down, everybody knows that. And that, you know, that's what they've got to fear more than anything else. And I'll be honest though, we need to be careful what we wish for as well, because, you know, it won't be pleasant to live through something like a Great Depression for any of us. There'll be a time where we'll look back fondly on, like, you know, 2018 and eating popcorn and watching like silly Trump tweets. We'll wonder about how good we ever had it, you know? A note of caution for the accelerationists as well. Peter says, at the end of the segment on Friday in the studio, Amapour said to Tony Blair, "Heavy is the head that wears the crown." Yes, indeed. So there we go. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I'll be back tomorrow night with Unpopular Opinions, and I'll see you then. Make sure you pick up Foundations of Politics. It's almost ready. Subscribe to my Substack, join the channel, buy a mug, but most importantly of all, get out.